Hey everybody, welcome back to what is going to be a tumultuous episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. We've got a million things to talk about in just a little bit. We're going to be breaking down the Justice Department's sort of strategic shift on the ACA that could result in countless millions of Americans being thrown off their health insurance. Also, Donald Trump and Puerto Rico. One of those two things has driven the other insane. We'll see which is which. Later on, AIPAC is going on, and only one topic was being discussed, and that's Ilhan Omar. Virtually everyone bringing her up. We're going to break down the various things that were said about the new representative. Later on in the show, Fox News' war on AOC. We're going to be reporting from the front lines and see how that campaign is currently going. And very exciting, later on in the show, Alexandra Rojas of Justice Democrats is going to be joining us to break down their strategy going into the 2020 midterms, some of the candidates that they've already been talking to, and some tips for you to be able to decide, should you run for elected office? And we're going to be talking with one of the women who is perhaps best placed to help people make that determination. Want to see more people get involved in politics? Maybe you could be the next AOC or the next Ayanna Pressley. And then we're going to close the show. There's a debate on the floor of Congress right now over the Green New Deal. And Star Wars came up. And so we're going to break down exactly why that is. Why did a debate about the Green New Deal result in Mark Hamill tweeting me this morning? Doesn't make any sense. We're going to break it down a little bit later on. So first, let's jump into domestic news, though. I've heard a lot over the past day or two about how these are the best days of the Trump presidency, because as we all know, the best day in any man's life is when he finds out that an investigation hasn't produced enough actionable evidence for him to be thrown out of office and just results in his personal lawyer, his campaign manager, his national security advisor, and a bunch of other people going down for a countless list of felonies. But let's say it is the best days. The Trump administration sure seems to want to destroy that and to throw themselves back into the dark side of American politics, because the Justice Department announced that they're making a pretty big change on their stance vis-a-vis the ACA and the future of Obamacare. The Justice Department said in a brief filed yesterday that the administration supports a recent district court decision that invalidated all of Obamacare. So it's now the official position of President Trump's administration that all of the ACA, private insurance markets that cover 15 million Americans, the Medicaid expansion that covers another 15 million, and the protections for people with pre-existing conditions and other regulations should be nullified. So they go from the best days of the presidency to a measurable percentage of all of the Americans in the world should lose their health insurance. And by the way, I don't know the exact numbers. I don't know how it breaks down state by state. How many millions, if you throw 30 million people off their health insurance, how many of those people own red hats? 5 million? 10 million? 20 million, maybe, if the states shake out that way? And so a gigantic middle finger to Trump voters coming from the Trump administration. And also, by the way, all of the lofty promises that he got so much credit for back during the Republican primary and then during the general election, where he was the Republican that wasn't going to cut Medicare and Medicaid. That was proven to be a lie just a couple of weeks ago when he brought in his budget that cuts Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and other programs like that. No, he's the Republican that's going to push for universal health care. He said that multiple times. Well, he's moving in the wrong direction then, if he's going to take more than 10% of all the adults in America and throw them off their health insurance. And also, if you're one of the many people who has a pre-existing condition, and you remember those dark days before Obamacare when it meant that you would either have to pay far more for your insurance, or you just couldn't get the insurance at all, or if you had insurance and then you needed the money, and then they found out that you had a pre-existing condition, they just throw you off and let you die. We could be moving back in that direction thanks to Donald Trump and his Justice Department. So that is obviously a disaster. This is exactly what the 2020 election is going to be run on. These sorts of lies being told by the Trump administration, these sorts of abuses against those who can least afford to be abused by the Trump administration, he is making it all the more easy for Democratic contenders in this next cycle to run successfully against him while pursuing a proactive agenda that would not kill millions of Americans. So that'll be nice. And by the way, if you want a nice contrast, on this exact same day that we're finding out and processing this change in the Justice Department, Democrats in Congress have put forward a piece of legislation that will, in the end, be separated into a few aimed at strengthening the ACA in a number of different ways. Now, this is not my preferred path forward. I want Medicare for all. I want the elimination of private health insurance and for people to be protected under a system that virtually everyone in America already likes, which is Medicare. But these changes are also good, too, along the way. So here's just a quick summary of a few of the things that have been proposed today by the House Democratic Caucus. They want to expand the tax credits available under the law, both reducing costs for lower-income families and expanding to universal eligibility so middle-class Americans can receive federal assistance. Let's pause there for 1 second. So what does that mean in practice? Well, if you were making the least amount of money in the smallest bracket, you might have been paying up to 5% of your income on health insurance under the ACA. In this, it would be capped at 2%, so you would have to pay less of your total income for your insurance. If you're in a higher bracket, it would cut by about 3% of your income, how much has to go towards paying for your health insurance. So again, for even more Americans, it would be cheaper. And it also means that for the first time, there's no longer a cap on who actually gets to benefit from these sorts of subsidies. They will be expanded to everyone. Now, that in practice might not be necessary. I don't know why millionaires necessarily need these sorts of subsidies, but it will be a popular move, I'm sure, for people who are middle class or slightly above that don't want to pay as high of a percentage of their income on health insurance. So overall, it seems like a pretty positive move. It also creates a national reinsurance program to offset high medical bills for insurers and thereby keep premium increases in check. So that's a bit of sort of disaster insurance to some extent. It also rolls back Trump actions expanding skimpier health insurance plans, giving states the freedom to undermine the law's benefits requirements and cutting enrollment outreach funding. So there a lot of stuff is being summarized in that, but basically the Trump administration over the past few years has brought back the pre-Obamacare health insurance plans that don't actually insure your health in any real sense, where you get to pay a little bit for health insurance, feel like you've got it, but God help you if you actually get really sick. They brought back those plans and are trying to expand them right now. They're pretty popular, by the way, because it seems like, well, I don't have to pay as much, and I could never get sick. Look at what I eat. But that's what Trump is doing, and they want to fight back against that. Also, they've tried to make it so that fewer and fewer Americans even know that the ACA is an option for them. That's why they've been cutting funds for advertising and things like that. They want to reverse that, too. So a pretty amazing day, a tale of two positions on the ACA. Trump wants to destroy it, wants to throw 30 million plus Americans off their health insurance, and the Democrats, while not yet accepting something like Medicare for All, are at least not doing that. And so if the Trump administration had a good news cycle before this, I think a lot of that goodwill is probably evaporated. With that, let's move on to another topic. Puerto Rico is still reeling far more than a year after the hurricane that knocked out power across wide areas of the island. Many of the schools and clinics and things like that still damaged, haven't been repaired. Many areas still have intermittent power. It's a disaster, and it's getting worse, actually. So last week, to save money, a nonprofit called Casa Ismael, which relies on its patients' food stamp money for funding, will ask patients to sit in diapers in which they had repeatedly urinated, sometimes for hours. The Casa Ismael clinic is short on funds, in part because of cuts in food stamps that hit about 1.3 million residents of Puerto Rico this month. So we talked about this when it first happened, and now we're seeing the effects of it. Something like close to half of all of the people living in Puerto Rico benefit from that program, and that program last month was not renewed, which means that a lot of that funding is now gone, and you're starting to see that have ripple effects that are affecting other things. So people in this clinic, which is for people infected with HIV, are now going to be stuck sitting in diapers that were used hours ago because there just isn't money to replace it. Now, why is that? Well, the federal government originally provided additional food stamp aid to Puerto Rico after the hurricane, but Congress missed the deadline for reauthorization last March. They were focused on other things. At that point, early on, we were still dealing with the whole wall and national emergency declaration and all of that. At the time, Donald Trump, who we know has been no savior of Puerto Rico since the hurricane, wrote a letter calling the additional food stamp aid that was being debated, quote, excessive and unnecessary. Well, he's right. It is unnecessary unless you don't want to sit in a diaper for multiple hours in a clinic that has holes that have never been patched in the roof so that when it rains, it just comes into a medical facility. Then it would be necessary, I guess. But unnecessary if you don't mind that. And here's the thing. You might see that letter and think, oh, they're being fiscally conservative or something. Sure, in a callous, I would argue, cruel or evil way. But it turns out that this is actually the first indication of an ongoing campaign behind the scenes of Donald Trump and his administration to not just not give Puerto Rico what it needs, but to attempt to starve them of the resources they need to maintain basic functionality in medicine, energy, transportation, and all of that. At an Oval Office meeting back in February, Trump asked top advisors for ways to limit federal support from going to Puerto Rico, believing it's taking money that should be going to the mainland. perhaps areas that look a little bit more like him and his family. A senior administration official with direct knowledge of the meeting described Trump's stance, quote, he doesn't want another single dollar going to the island. So we already know that in the immediate aftermath and the year after, not nearly enough resources were put into there. Now he thinks we were probably doing too much, and we have to figure out some way, without getting too much bad press, to make sure that Puerto Rico is left in the lurch and doesn't have the resources they need to maintain food supplies and things like that. It goes on, though. Trump said, quote, it's ridiculous how much money is going to Puerto Rico in food stamp aid. He has occasionally groused about how ungrateful political officials in Puerto Rico were for the administration's help. If you don't remember the help, it came in the form of him throwing paper towels at people. He thinks that he should have gotten more credit for that. And by the way, if you want to understand what leads a man to have that sort of stance, watch our video from last week about narcissistic personality disorder and how much people need to be constantly praised for the little that they do. It explains a lot of Trump in this area and others. So since then, since he said that, aides have described the president who regularly brings up the island to make sure it's not getting too much money. So in conversations about other topics, he will pivot to Puerto Rico asking if they have gotten any extra money because he doesn't want them to. He's bringing it up at random times. That is beyond sort of ambivalent about what happens at the island. That is like willful targeted cruelty against a population that can ill afford it. And so here's the interesting thing. Why are we in this position at all? Why is it that Congress can miss a deadline that results in clinics being devastated? Well, it's because it's not a state. So if the island would not need Congress to step in if it was a state. For states, the federal government has committed to funding those programs' needs, whatever the cost, and without needing to take a vote. It would have been automatic. They would have had it. But Puerto Rico instead funds its programs through a block grant from the federal government, which needs to be regularly renewed, and also gives food stamp benefits about 40% smaller than those of states, which means that you have to hope, oh, I hope the Senate's on our side this month, and even if they are, we're going to get less money. Even though we're Americans, we're going to be screwed over if they even remember that we exist. And in this case, they appear to have forgotten. Now, there is supposed to be a vote on renewing that food stamp funding, perhaps sometime in the next week. Donald Trump had been saying that he would not support it, that he would, in fact, veto the legislation if it happened. It appears that he has backed off that position. But he also feels really emboldened right now. So emboldened that he recently announced that they're not going to be supporting the ACA in the courts anymore. And so God only knows, coming out of this last week of news, what his position on Puerto Rico and their food stamp aid will actually be. But here at TYT, we will be watching. With that, we are going to take a break. When we come back, lots more to get.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So do you remember when there was that scandal a few weeks back about Ilhan Omar's comments and a news cycle several days long was devoted to breaking every single letter of her tweets down? And then we actually had a condemnation on the floor of the House that a bunch of Republicans ended up voting against because it was denouncing Islamophobia. All of that around Ilhan Omar's comments. Well, weeks later, we have not moved on as a country. At AIPAC, there's one person on everyone's mind, and it is still Ilhan Omar. They're not all referencing her specifically by name, but people that are both Democrats, Republicans, pundits, and politicians all bringing her up. And so I want to break down this pile on one person at a time. And the first is Chuck Schumer, a guy who will apparently go to his grave still talking about this story. Let's go to a little video of Chuck Schumer not just denouncing Ilhan Omar, but literally comparing her to Nazis.
When someone names only prominent Jews as trying to buy or steal our elections, we must call it out. When someone says that being Jewish and supporting Israel means you're not loyal to America, we must call it out. When someone looks at a neo-Nazi rally and sees some very fine people among its company, we must call it out. When someone suggests that money drives support for Israel, we must call it out.
Someday an autopsy is going to be done on America, and the cause of death will be both sides. And so there he is saying that if you bring up the corrosive influence of money in politics, you are no different than groups of Nazis that marched in America and killed a protester. It was worthy of as much talk by Chuck Schumer right there. Same exact thing. Now, yes, he did reference the Nazis. He referenced, I think that was about either Glenn Beck or Tucker Carlson in the beginning about saying that they're the only ones that are buying politicians. I'm not entirely sure. He was being very vague there. There are actual Nazis. There are actual people whose entire career has been based on Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, homophobia, racism, misogyny in the media. And then there are people who sent a tweet that people didn't like. You can say justifiably or not justifiably. But to compare those things is insanity. But on this issue, Chuck Schumer is insane. Take a look at a quote from last year's AIPAC from Chuck Schumer. He was talking about why there isn't peace between Israel and Palestinians right now. Obviously, that is a complex topic. There's a lot that goes into that. I'm not an expert on the topic. But I can identify what's not the actual cause of that. And look at what Chuck Schumer said. He said, of course, we say it's our land. The Torah says it. But they don't believe in the Torah. So that's the reason there's not peace. Chuck Schumer is free in America to believe whatever he wants. But the idea that there is not peace between Israelis and Palestinians because the Palestinians have chosen the wrong religion, I don't think that that's actually the reason. But look, Chuck Schumer, one of the most powerful Democrats in the country at AIPAC, feels free to say that this entire population has chosen wrong when it comes to religion, and that's why they're still being occupied. That's why they're still in the squalor and oppression that they're in. That was just last year. That's not a quote from 10 years ago. It's not a quote from 30 years ago. That was last year. And now, both sidesism. Ilhan Omar, American Nazis, who can actually say which is worse? But it wasn't just Chuck Schumer. He was on the same side of this issue effectively as people like Mike Pence, who said, it's astonishing to think that the party of Harry Truman has been co-opted by people who promote rank anti-Semitic rhetoric. And as I stand before you, 8 Democrat candidates for president are actually boycotting this very conference. So let me be clear on this point. Anyone who aspires to the highest office in the land should not be afraid to stand with the strongest supporters of Israel in America. It is wrong to boycott Israel, and it's wrong to boycott AIPAC. So there are like a lot of things to break down there. I'm going to start at the end and then work my way back. He said it's wrong to boycott Israel, and it's wrong to boycott AIPAC. It's not wrong to boycott anything. It can be silly in a particular case to boycott something, but it is your right to not go to a thing or pay for a thing if that's not what you want to do. But in this particular case especially, AIPAC is a lobbying group. To say that it is the same to boycott a country and a lobbying group is insanity. But that is his position. Now, you move back a little bit. He's saying there's 8 Democrat candidates for president who are boycotting it. Oh, my God, I did not know that, actually. There are politicians who aren't going to AIPAC. What are their chances in this primary? How could anyone get elected, especially, as he says, to the highest office in the land if they don't go to AIPAC? It would never actually happen. Except, weirdly, Trump didn't go in 2015 and 2016. Also, he skipped this year. He's not going to AIPAC right now. So as his vice president is saying no one could get elected who doesn't go, Trump is off playing virtual golf in the White House or something. But that, of course, was lost on him. And then rank anti-Semitic rhetoric. So this is not a thing where Ilhan Omar needs to choose her words more carefully or whatever. This was rank anti-Semitism. This is the worst anti-Semitism. You can't say anything any more anti-Semitic. So that is where we're at. Weeks and weeks after this scandal initially started, you've got some of the most powerful Democrats and the most powerful Republicans dogpiling on top of Ilhan Omar over these comments that she has already done so much work to refine what she intended, to work to sort of bridge the gap with that community if it exists in her own district. But that's what's continuing. By the way, there was another person who had a problem with Ilhan Omar, and this was sort of a funny interaction. Benjamin Netanyahu. He said, from this Benjamin, it's not about the Benjamins, referencing one of her tweets. That's sort of a funny line. But I have a funnier one I like better. So Ilhan Omar responded by saying, this from a man facing indictments for bribery and other crimes in three separate public corruption affairs. So perhaps it is about the Benjamins, but it's more of an internal corruption and bribery thing. Maybe choose your words a little bit more carefully. But there's one other aspect to this. Meghan McCain was at AIPAC for reasons. And here's what she had to say.
Israel. Many of you know there are people out there today, including in the halls of Congress, who believe that America supports Israel only because AIPAC is powerful. That line, recalling so many pernicious stereotypes, is a profound misunderstanding of how American democracy works. Americans don't support Israel because AIPAC is influential. AIPAC is influential because Americans support Israel.
Why is she there? Does anyone, does she know why she's there? Anyway, she's there, I guess. She's famous and influential, got a great name. She's always going to be fine in politics. I wish I'd been born with a better name, I guess. But anyway, let's go to the substance of what she said, what little substance there was. She said people support AIPAC because they just do or whatever. I think that that's the essence of her comment there. Here's the thing, again, I don't know why we need to keep reminding people of this. AIPAC's a lobby, like any lobby. You can lobby for whatever you want. You're free to do that. But the idea that the lobby itself is powerful because people already support that thing, like apply that to literally any other area. So why do the cigarette companies have a lobby? If we lived in a world where everybody was smoking up and everybody loved it and there were no concerns, why would you be spending millions of dollars on lobbying for a thing? You lobby because there is disagreement. There's disagreement philosophically or strategically, pragmatically, in cigarettes as in support for the particular policies of any country's current government or governing party, if you want to go a little bit broader. AIPAC is currently free, as any lobbying group is, to try to influence politicians, sure. But people disagree. And she's pretending, she's silencing everyone who currently doesn't agree, not with Israel, but with individual policies of this individual currently elected government. The idea, that's a larger conversation. We don't have time to get into it, unfortunately. But again, it is not the same to oppose a lobby and to oppose a country. And the idea that it is un-American to say that we should question money going not from AIPAC, from literally any lobby to politicians and say that's not why they're supporting it. I would say for the vast majority of elected politicians, the money they're getting from industries is a not insignificant chunk of why they support literally any policy. I think that sure, deep down at their core, if you had an electron tunneling microscope and you were able to look into Mike Lee's heart, maybe he has a preference on certain issues, but it damn sure is affected by the money he's currently getting from those industries. And that has to do with Israel, other countries, the healthcare industry, the military-industrial complex, literally any issue you can come up with. They're not giving them the money because they think that they dress nice. They're giving them the money to influence how they vote. That is true of every lobby. That is the point Ilhan Omar was trying to make. That is the point that progressives have been making for a very long time. And hopefully, at some point, people will wise up to that. Perhaps not Meghan McCain, but reasonable people. We're going to take a short break. We come back stuff after this. So there always has to be an enemy, Fox News and the Republican Party. There's a lot of overlap in the Venn diagram. For a long time, the last few years, it was Hillary Clinton. attack Hillary Clinton. She is the figurehead of the Democratic Party, at least in their mind. If you take her down, you take down the Democrats and the liberals and all of that. But times have changed so much since then. They've just found a different woman to attack. And this time, it's AOC. And so Fox News is very happy to broadcast a headline. Ocasio-Cortez's unfavorable rating skyrockets, with most people viewing her negatively. Most people, that is one of the terms in that headline that we're going to return to shortly. So let's go to the substance of this from the actual poll. Since September, Ocasio-Cortez's net favorability dropped most sharply among Republicans, white Americans, men, and Americans over 55, although by far the largest drop there is amongst Republicans, shockingly. At the same time, net favorability increased among non-white Americans by +9 and Democrats by +8. So, first of all, like, you can report on polls in a lot of different ways, but you should acknowledge some not stated but fairly obvious facts. So in that past one, they said, we've identified four groups where she's gone down. Oh, my God, that's a big concern. Republicans, white Americans, men, and Americans over 55. Is it possible that there's a little bit of overlap between those groups, that if you were to look at Republicans and then zoom in a little bit, you might find some white Americans, some men, and some people over 55, but it's presented as four different categories. What is actually true there is that Republicans don't like her as much. What's not true is what was in the headline, that most people view her negatively. That's factually incorrect. She still has, it's plurality is what they mean, but they want to imply that, oh no, you hate her, everybody hates her, don't worry about that. By the way, not stated so much, but also true, Guardian reported on this, a majority of women and Americans aged 18 to 34 still have a favorable opinion of the congresswoman. And so the thing is, like they say, most Americans don't like her. What is in truth is that stereotypical white, older, male Republicans aren't big fans of her. All the rest still very favorable towards her, and she pointed that out in a tweet saying, if you want to know what subconscious bias looks like, it's a headline saying AOC is underwater with every group except women, non-whites, and 18 to 34-year-olds. So older conservative white men are considered everyone, and everyone else is discounted as an exception. But the thing is, I don't think that that's any sort of subconscious bias. I think that that is Fox News knowing their audience. And the thing is, they're scared of AOC, I mean the audience and Fox News, and they definitely want to be told that everyone agrees with them. So you lie about the numbers and imply that the campaign against her has been successful outside of just Fox News. And it is a campaign, by the way. In the 134 days since Election Day, Ocasio-Cortez's name appeared in 1,173 separate stories on Fox News alone. In fact, they even added a tag for AOC, so that if you'd like to see other Fox News coverage about AOC, you can just see that. Which sort of seems for the average Fox News member to be kind of abusive. Why would you force them to see something that they're not going to like? But apparently they're clicking on it. And so here's the thing. Fox News is reporting on this as if it's just like, oh yeah, it's happening over there. We don't have anything to say about that. But we know that Fox News has been AOC TMZ for the past couple of months. They make every issue about her, even if it has nothing to do with her. And that is not by accident. It's not just because she's famous. It's because they think this is a shortcut to taking down all of the actual challenges to status quo thinking, to establishment, economics, and politics, if they can just take her down. They're very scared of what she represents, not just in terms of the fact that she is a passionate advocate for actual bold policies, but also the implicit demographic trends that she is signaling. And we're seeing that in other elections as well, but she is at this point the figurehead. So they need to take her down, not because they're necessarily scared of conservatives voting for her, but they want other people to think, ah, there's something kind of wrong about her. Like, they've already convinced most Fox News viewers that she's crazy, she dances too much, whatever. But what they want is for you to start to question her. Because what she provides is not just great messaging on the Green New Deal and taxation and things like that. What she is providing is hope and inspiration. And that is what they want to kill. Not just her reputation, but your belief that things can actually get better. That at some point we will move beyond people like Lindsey Graham and Donald Trump. And I would throw people like Chuck Schumer in there as well. That there is a better future ahead. They want to massacre that idea. And they want you to check out again. They don't want you voting in the next election. They don't want you paying attention and staying engaged during the primaries. They certainly don't want you running for office. And as long as she is there, a shining beacon of light, implying that there are good people, there are genuine people, there are people who can do it the right way and provide a model that others can follow, That is not something that they can abide. And that is why the Republican politicians pay attention to her so much. That is why Fox News devotes so much of their coverage to her, exactly because of what she represents. And they can try to pretend that her unfavorables have skyrocketed when what they really mean is that we've been successful in making white male Republicans not like her, which was never going to be all that difficult considering their predilections. That is what they have, but they want to convince you that it goes beyond that so that you will lose hope as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about actually the group attempting to inspire more hope. That is the Justice Democrats. The executive director, Alexandra Rojas, is going to be joining us. Should you run in the next cycle? We'll be giving you some advice after this. The midterms were just months ago, but if we want to get a jump on the next cycle, if people want to get in there and actually run and possibly get elected to Congress or other offices, there is no time to waste. And so joining us now to break down how this next cycle is going to go, and if you perhaps should run yourself, we've got Alexandra Rojas of Justice Democrats. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
Great to have you here. Always glad to talk to you. So what I'm curious about overall, there's a bunch of things I want to jump into, but you guys have, this is your second cycle now. How do things feel inside the Justice Democrats compared to this same time the first time around, before you had tracked down all the candidates, before you had these huge wins? How do things feel now in comparison to that first time around?
It feels like we're actually prepared. last time, right? And I think part of our strength, right, is that we didn't come from sort of the typical way that you enter politics. A lot of the original founders of Justice Democrats, including myself, came out of the Bernie 2016 campaign, where for a lot of the first time, it was our first time organizing, but we sort of knew that we needed a Congress, we needed one that actually looked like the rest of America, and one that was ready to sort of also mobilize and organize in the way that we saw during that campaign, which was through sort of grassroots organizing, utilizing a lot of new distributed progressive technology. And so now that we've gone through not only, you know, a presidential size campaign, we've also worked on over 65 different congressional races from last cycle to kind of prepare us for going in eyes wide open about all of the hurdles that we're going to face. I think one of the biggest ones, right, is going to be fundraising. Another huge one was going to be media. And we're definitely making inroads there. And then when it comes to candidate recruitment, we are kind of always in candidate recruitment mode, right? We're not just thinking about 2020, but we're also thinking about beyond, right? Because as a movement, we really need to build out, progressive bench and infrastructure to be able to support working people across all backgrounds. So it's going great as of right now, and I'm sure you'll ask me lots of questions about the types of candidates soon. So
yeah, and actually, sort of overall, in terms of that recruitment, like I imagine in the first year or so, as you're finding people and starting up their campaigns, the media completely ignored it. Even on the eve of many of their elections, they're like, maybe they'll get one or whatever, even though two sitting members of Congress joined up. And now you've got some of the most high-profile, headline-generating people in elected office. So are you finding that it's easier to get people, are more people interested in running this time around, thanks to the success in the first cycle?
Yeah, I think that we have the opposite problem. Sort of what happened last time was there's like six or seven people running in primaries in red to blue districts. Now we have so many people running in primaries against Democrats across the country. So it's actually really, really awesome. There's a lot of people out there that are interested in running, and we're still sort of going through the process. And one of the things that I'm sure you can imagine is happening is that we're seeing, you know, women and especially women of color not wanting to sort of take the plunge out there. We're having to do a lot of convincing to these incredible women who are, you know, doing incredibly important work to their communities, that when we ask them, hey, why don't you go be a voice of one in 435, they sort of question that idea. But what's been really incredible is that we can point to, look at the success of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, look at the success of Ilhan Omar and Ayanna Pressley, where we've been able to completely shift the political landscape to make it so that, you know, working class women of color actually can enter the halls of Congress. And so we're seeing a lot of people step up to run, and we're really, really excited to support as many people as possible. But we need to make sure that the people that are sort of doing the work in their communities right now and sort of have these simple but profound stories of, you know, sort of like Alexandria, right? Because her story isn't really that unique when you look at the rest of the American people. What was unique about her was her incredible communication skills and also her ability to be courageous, right, in the face of fear. And we're looking for those people all throughout the country. And so right now, if you know those types of people, especially women, because they're going to need the biggest push, nominate them at justicedemocrats.com/nominate. And if you have anyone that you know that has access to an email list of some sorts, we're definitely hoping to spread the message far and wide.
So that's great advice. And hopefully your problem of in some districts weeding down to the exact right person, I would like to make that a harder problem for you by generating more people who are interested in running. So for those
that's
who
the best
might,
problem to have.
Exactly. For those who might be thinking about it, what are some considerations that they should think about? How can they know that it would be right for them, that they would be able to make it through a potentially grueling campaign? What are some factors that they should consider?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things is why are you running, right? I think a lot of times the why is very difficult to figure out. For everyone, it's going to be different. A lot of people right now are, you know, because I'm seeing Alexandria, I'm seeing Ilhan, I'm seeing Ayanna and Rashida fight in Congress, and they want to sort of be like them. And that's really, really incredible. But I think we also have to balance that with the actual work that people are doing in their communities that sort of give them leverage as to why they should be in elected office. Mm-hmm. So for Alexandria, right, she was someone who was an educator. She saw her family struggle during the financial crisis and was someone that totally was not thinking about running for office until she felt like there was a need to do so. Mm-hmm. She was at a position in her life where it was possible. And for working people, that's a really hard thing. So I think the advice that I give to people is if you're really, really thinking about it, you know, as much as we're, you know, going to help as much as we can with fundraising, the reality is, as progressives, is we're going to get outspent, but we're going to need to work incredibly, incredibly hard in the field to build a base of support. Mm-hmm. And so if you have any sort of ties to your community, and community being, right, not just the local activist community, but you know, people in union working spaces, right? People in your own hospital, people in your school, right? They're these sort of central pieces that make up a community to be able to, you know, have some sort of base of support before you launch and to give reason as to why you want to challenge the incumbent. Yeah. So I think the sort of personal story is really important. And then I think the policy piece, right, is paramount to all of this. I don't think that, you know, all of our candidates entering this process were super wonky and knew every single detail there was about policy, but they had a foundational understanding that in order for us to create change, it's not just about them. They're not a silver bullet, right? They are part of a larger movement of candidates at rejecting the idea of looking at elections in silos and trying to advance an entire movement. And that means that the policies that we run on and form the sort of grassroots nature of the campaigns that we also run on, we have to run on big ideas to ask people to do big things. And that's going to require someone's ability to be able to galvanize that and really inspire people. Part of that's going to be their story, and part of it is also going to be understanding that the issues that we're running on are systemic. And the reason why Green New Deal, for example, is so big is because in order to talk about climate change, you also have to talk about equity. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of, you know, this through this sort of intersectional lens and running on big ideas, kind of fueling that and big organizing is, I think, really unique to the approach that at least Justice Democrats candidates will run on.
Well, Alexandra, thank you, as always, for coming on the show. Obviously, we're big fans of the organization. I'm very excited to see who you're fielding this time around. Perhaps in a couple of months, once you've identified some candidates, we can talk a little bit about some of them, people that people might want to support, and also a little bit about a strategy going forward in this this cycle.
That sounds great.
Okay, have a good day. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're actually going to be talking about the Green New Deal. It's being debated technically on the floor of the Congress right now, and it has already gone to comedic, even sci-fi lengths. We'll show you how after this. It's So the Republicans want to hold a show vote on the Green New Deal, which means debate, for whatever that counts for in the modern day, is happening right now in Congress. And because I've been doing the show this morning, I've only been able to check in sort of intermittently. But even from casual viewing of it, one thing is very clear. The Republicans have lost their goddamn minds. And I don't just say because they don't support the Green New Deal or because they lie about the cost and things like that. They're wasting America's time with complete and utter nonsense. And I want to show you what I mean in a couple of images. So Waleed Shaheed, he put up this tweet. Let's bring that up. And Senator Mike Lee, he's going to focus on, is discussing the Green New Deal. And he attached some photos that he'd taken, screenshots. He says these are not photoshopped. And the reason he said that is because even though I'm giving you this caveat, there's no way you won't believe that these aren't photoshopped. Let's go to the first. That's Ronald Reagan riding on a velociraptor as he shoots what looks like, it's not an Uzi, but some sort of submachine gun. And the raptor is holding an American flag. That's next to Mike Lee as he's debating climate change. I don't know if that's his alternative plan for how you eliminate carbon in the atmosphere. It would be cool. I don't think it would be successful in lowering global temperatures. But that's what he put up. And then we've got this one. I think that's Aquaman riding a gigantic pink fish thing. Do you think that's a seahorse? Yeah, I guess it's got the mouth of a seahorse. Is that about rising ocean levels? I don't see how that doesn't just confirm what we've been talking about. See, Aquaman cares about the oceans, and the oceans are being devastated by climate change. Then there's this. He's got a picture of babies. This one I actually have the context for. I didn't know what he meant there, but there is context. He said this: the solution to climate change is not this unserious resolution. The solution to so many of our problems at all times and in all places is, I ask you not, to fall in love, get married, and have some kids. So the solution to climate change, which is not purely created by overpopulation, but it's certainly not helping, is to have more babies. Which, by the way, even if that was the solution, that's kind of like a decades-long solution, and we kind of have a problem right now. But he's seriously, he's an elected politician, and he's saying that if you care about climate change, what you need to do is forget about politics, go off, bone, and raise a baby. And surely, and raise a baby into a world that's going to be devastated by climate change. And what's so frustrating about this, like, I sort of did this story because it's funny, but it's not really funny, because that guy's vote on the Green New Deal is worth any senator with a PhD in climate science. They have the exact same influence over whether America actually does something about climate change. I don't think that that guy was able to button his own suit jacket, and yet he gets to decide, potentially, whether we do something about climate change or continue to see global average temperatures go up, seas rise, and all of that. There's one more, though. I'm going to go back into, hopefully, a little bit lighter territory that I had to tweet about. It's a real, real image. I put this up. I've waited my whole life for The Empire Strikes Back to be recognized on the floor of Congress, and Senator Mike Lee had to come along and ruin it. Because that's a photo of aspiring Jedi Luke Skywalker. He hasn't yet been trained at that point. Let's understand that. It's sort of an incipient Jedi thing. Riding a Tauntaun on Hoth. Is he trying to make the point that if we remove too much carbon, like, things will get colder and we'll look like Hoth? Is this a thing about the military-industrial complex and AT-ATs? I honestly don't know at this point. But I tweeted about that, and the weirdest thing to come of all this is that Mark Hamill retweeted and said, please tell me this is photoshopped. Hashtag congressional tauntaun pawn. So he's at least enjoying himself, and it is funny, at least for a moment. But it's not funny for our species or for our civilization, because we've got some politicians, thankfully, who are finally taking this seriously. So people both in the Senate and people like AOC who are pushing for the Green New Deal, these are people who are not only willing to do the right thing, but understand the reasons to do it, the reasons based on our values and in sound climate science. They're the real deal on these issues. And they have to get past people like Mike Lee. And they sort of acknowledge that. AOC tweeted in response to this, like many other women and working people, I occasionally suffer from imposter syndrome, those small moments, especially on hard days, where you wonder if the haters are right. But then they do things like this to clear it right up. If this guy can be your senator, you can do anything. And that is true. perhaps including being a senator. So as we were talking about earlier in the show, perhaps run, perhaps try to be a candidate under the Justice Democrats. And that's what they're doing. They're talking about Tauntauns and Aquaman and Velociraptors. Those are three of my favorite things. But there's a right time and place when we're talking about the Green New Deal. Finally, at long last in D.C., that is not the right time and it's not the right place. Thank you to everybody who was watching this episode of The Damage Report. If you enjoyed it, please rate it and review it on iTunes. Very important. Share videos, by the way. It's very difficult to find content. There's so much out there. If you're a fan of the show and of my style of covering the news, then please help me spread that. We've got so much more planned for the rest of the week. It should be a lot of fun, so we will see you tomorrow morning with a lot more.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.